It's very easy when we start reading through the New Testament, especially Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, to some degree in the book of Acts, to look at scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, and say, well, yes, these were religious groups in Jesus' day, and they were not favorably disposed towards the Lord for the most part, but let's continue on and press on through the text. But when you start looking at some of the information about the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Sanhedrin, we begin to realize some things that are relevant to our day and time. So we did that to some degree last week as far as the handout on the Pharisees. I have revised this. I was reminded of some information that I knew about but had never brought forward, I don't think, as far as Goshen. And when you look at the Pharisees, you go back and you take a look at the Talmud. There are sources, including that one, which indicate that there were different types, different classifications of Pharisees. And if that's not something you've ever looked at, I think that in our study of Pharisees is also worth exploring. So as you look at the sheet, Barclay in his commentary on Matthew makes it easy as far as trying to break these fellows down into the seven different types. He talks about, for example, the shoulder Pharisees. Definition for that is point three. These men wore their good deeds in their shoulders and wanted to be seen of men. Now you see that specifically addressed by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 and Matthew chapter 6. He talks about they want to be seen for their almsgiving. They want to be seen for their prayers. They want to be seen as far as the enlarged borders and the garments and so forth. And maybe that's what Jesus had in mind, this specific type of Pharisee. Can you think about some people today who want to be seen or noted for their good works? Who does that? Who acts in that kind of way?
Politicians.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably one of the better answers that we can give. I was the one who brought the bridge. I was the one who brought these jobs. I was the one who did this or that. And they do good works, and maybe to some degree they are good-hearted. But at the bottom, at the end of the day, the bottom line is they want to be reelected. So sometimes they will trot out, they will parade the good that they did. So when it's reelection time, you may hear about their list of accomplishments, so to speak. Who else? They want to be seen for the good works.
I think a lot of the television evangelists
are doing that very same thing that we see. Yeah, we're spending money on wells in Africa, and people are getting food, people are getting water and so forth, so send us money. These are good works. Now sometimes it's a statement of fact. But you do have other cases where they go beyond that. They're tooting their own horn, so to speak. And in that case, you're looking at people who often want more money. Any others? All right. You look at some high-profile people. That would be a little different than the example that Ray just gave us. But yes, some of the things that he's done, some of the things that the Catholic Church has been involved with, the Pope, he would also at times fall into that category. Anybody else? Libraries, endowment scholarships for schools. Sometimes it's a new building at a university, and you don't know all the inner workings there, but oftentimes it looks like, hey, I'll give you X million, and you go ahead and make sure that my name is prominently displayed on the building. So it's interesting that that does work that way sometimes, that we will give you the money, but in return you make sure that our name is going to be on the building. Okay. There have been several examples of that where major donations result in that kind of thing.
And they're good things.
Right. And it may be, I've known, for example, I'm thinking if anybody's been up to Camp Indigan and you've seen the Dilgard Pavilion, I knew enough about the Dilgard family to know that I don't think that their name, in their mind, they cared whether or not their name was on that pavilion or not. I think that probably in the case of the camp was, we just want to put your name on there, and they didn't fight that. It was, well, you know, we don't need that, we don't want that, but again, we're going to leave it up to you. But the people who were going to be involved with that construction said, this is something we really want to do, and they consented. So nothing wrong in that case, but there have been some individuals who have gone in a much different direction. Carol? Pharisee, and who's that? We've got the shoulder Pharisee, and we've also got the wait a little Pharisee. I like that one. And the wait a little Pharisee, what's he like?
Procrastinator.
Are you? Yeah, that would be a good way to summarize him. He is the procrastinator. Wants to do good, maybe intends to do good, but we'll wait a little while.
Yeah.
And maybe you wait long enough and that no longer needs to be done, or maybe somebody else will have taken care of it and so forth. So they always had a quote-unquote valid reason for putting off a good deed. Do we have... Yes, and that's why I mentioned these seven, that when you start looking at them, we can relate very easily to what we're looking at here. So these seven types of Pharisees, we could easily say the seven types of Christians. And, yeah, so it does hit home, certainly. The wait a little Pharisee. And people will sometimes do that today. Just give me a little time, and I'll take care of it. And, well, sometimes that's around the house, you know. Give me a little time, and I'll take care of it. And, well...
More convenient time.
Yeah, more convenient time, and that convenient time never comes. All right, then you have number six. A third type of Pharisee was the bruised or the bleeding Pharisee. Now, this is really the one that, in my mind, is the one that's so odd, it's easy to remember. And, in fact, when I was discussing this with someone, this is one of the ones that both came to our mind just because it was so unusual. But when you look at the first century, women were not highly regarded. Women, for the most part, were looked upon as being property. Sometimes animals were treated better than women. And if you were a highly respected teacher, even if it was your wife or your sister, someone who was close to you, you did not want to be seen speaking to a woman out in public just because it was, you know, women were kind of icky as far as their status in that day and time. So you have these Pharisees who have really gone overboard. They would close their eyes. This is point A, so they would not even see a woman in public. So, you know, they knew that things like lust would be wrong, but they decided we're going to go way past that and close our eyes. Well, if you're out in public and you close your eyes, it's pretty obvious what's going to happen, right? You're going to fall, you're going to bump into things, you're going to stumble, and you're probably going to be bruised and bloodied up. So that was how these fellows were described. If we try to make application of that to Christians today, would you say that there are some people who would fall into that category? Now, maybe not literally. You don't have typically Christians going around and closing their eyes and saying, okay, you know, I'm not going to, you know, look at a woman, or I'm not going to look at anything that might be sinful. So
some of us older ones can relate to it by falling.
Well, all right, physically you might have some falls in there, and that would be something that comes to mind. Anything else, though? Right?
I think today that we might overlook sin. People's lives are in our own life and not trying to take care of it.
Okay. Anybody else? Gary?
Some people can be incredibly, incredibly conservative, way too conservative than I mean, even if the girl wears flip-flops instead of shoes, they may think that's too casual to push their view person, whereas it's just a choice.
Yeah. I'm going to especially emphasize the first part of your answer. People can go further than what God has required or what God has said, and they become so conservative in their behavior that they really go to extremes. And there are different examples of that. You can apply that to worship. You can apply that to Christian living. And, you know, you always want to be careful. I mean, if that's a personal conviction, that's one thing. But if you're trying to bind that on others, then that becomes a problem. But becoming too conservative, too restrictive, is how we would apply this. Stan, did you have a thought there too?
Well, it's addressed elsewhere in the scriptures that when the rich man comes in, we find a front seat for him. When the poor man comes in, well, it's sit over here in this corner of the pew. Well, that is a little bit different than the generality. But the generality is that we often turn our heads the other way when someone does not appear to be as prosperous, does not appear to be as well off in several different ways than we are.
Okay.
Brad, we had those that were fasting, supposedly, and looked like they were in a lot of pain because they were going through all of this.
All the motions,
And
you find that today. People, well, you know, I've lost 10 pounds because I've been fasting and so forth. Well, okay. So, yeah. Sort of related to that is the next one. And what do we have as far as point eight? What kind of Pharisee here? He is the
humpback
Pharisee. What creates the humpback Pharisee?
He's all bowed over.
Yeah, and what's the reason for that? All hunched over, see him. Like an old man, maybe early in life, all hunched over.
Pretending to be in prayer constantly.
All right, pretending to be in prayer. He's the fella. He is so humble, he doesn't even want to lift up his feet from the ground. Just kind of shuffles along. You can just imagine, old man, I'm so humble. Well, when you have somebody doing that, it reminds me a little bit about the story we've heard at different times. The guy got the badge for humility. Anybody remember the story? They gave him a badge for humility. He pins it on, and they took it back. Nobody remembers that story? You know, you get the badge for humility. Where should that go?
In his pocket.
In the closet, in the plug. You know, you don't put that prominently on the vest and say, well, here I am. I'm Mr. Humble. You know, that's really counterproductive as far as what you're trying to do and what you're trying to convey. So if you really have that humility, you don't want to be shuffling over, you know, how do you display humility?
By not drawing attention.
Yeah, I mean, that's humility. But there are some people who would run around, well, I'm such a humble person. Well, yeah, I'm kind of thinking, that's not registering for me. That just doesn't sound right. So, but there were some people who did that kind of thing. And maybe their intentions were good, just like the other guys. But good intentions are not exactly what God wants. There's more to it. All right?
If you're humble, you don't pray.
Yes, and nobody should be hearing about that. There should be equality. You remember kids back in probably the 1800s, maybe into the early 1900s, but kids should be seen and not heard. So,
still think that.
Yeah, people still think that sometimes.
I was told that a lot.
That might date you as far as age, so I don't know why I'd want to say that. But anyway, when you think about humility, that should be seen and not heard. So same category there. All right, let's think about point number 10. What kind of Pharisee do we have next? He is the
ever-reckoning,
or we might say the compounding Pharisee. When you think about compounding, what comes to mind? Banking, interest, money, and so forth. And there were some people who, and you still find this today, they thought the more they did, the more God was in their debt. Don't we have that same kind of philosophy in our time? They're going to try to work their way to salvation. That is the mind of some. And you could go back to Carol's illustration, or maybe it was Bonnie's. I don't remember which one. But if we give the money for the endowment, or if we give the money for the new library, or we give the money for this medical center, then ultimately, when it comes time for the judgment, what's God going to do for me? Well, I gave $50 million and they got a new hospital or they got a new library. So if anybody's going to be not only allowed into heaven, but if anybody's going to be at the front of the line, who will it be? Going to be me. Well, there you again have a problem with pride as well. But you had this type of attitude with the Pharisees, and you find it also in the church today as well as life in general. So point number 11, we sum it up this way. These men saw religion in terms of profit and loss. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at the timid Pharisee or the fearing Pharisee? All right, what was this kind of guy like, the fearing Pharisee? I'm afraid God's going to be displeased, so I better do what? I better go out and make sure I've got all the external washings. Now, we talked about the other extreme, didn't we? Don't we have up there on the list? Which was the one that was the one who went too far? The bruised Pharisee, the bleeding Pharisee, right?
Yeah.
He's so afraid of life that he's going to cover his eyes and he bumps into stuff. And now you have this fella. He's the timid Pharisee. He's the fearing Pharisee. So he decides he's going to pay great attention to things like the washing of cups and make sure that no detail gets undone. Well, you could look at them in terms of the same. Both are going to extremes. That's certainly true. This fella is trying to emphasize getting every letter of the law. The other fella is trying to, you know, make sure that he doesn't see anything that's going to lead him to sin. Glenda? Sure, that could take that form, where the guy thinks I'm not going to go out, and that would especially be similar to the bleeding Pharisee, I'm not going to go out and possibly see a woman.
He's insecure in ways, in his salvation, and when he does these extra things, some people may compliment him on those things, which he feels like maybe he needs, you know, you think about it, and all to help him feel better about himself, maybe. I don't know. I think he's insecure.
Yeah, and this guy has a problem with God's grace.
Yes.
It's just like, I've got to make sure I'm perfect.
Yes.
Don't do anything correctly, and if I live perfectly, and I've got all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed, and I'm going to be saved. So I'll make sure I wash all the cups and everything. And tied in with him would be his cousin. That would be the bleeding Pharisee. And together they feel like they're in pretty good shape. So you've got six fellas, six different schools of thought. And you can understand as we look at life how those six different groups existed. And each one would say, well, this is the right way to God and so forth. And you need to be this kind of Pharisee. And then we get down to number seven. And what kind of Pharisee was number seven? He was the... Yeah, he loved God and he was trying to do what was right. Now, do you remember from last week's class I said not all the Pharisees were nuts? There were some of them who had their heads screwed on straight and they were thinking properly. Gamaliel seems to have been one of those guys as we look at Acts chapter 5. So I can't say for sure that Gamaliel was not one of the other types that we've looked at. But in my mind, and Paul, when you look at him, he also seems like he was more of the, I want to make sure I've got everything covered, but he was not one of these sort of crazy fellas. So when you look at the word Pharisee, it means the separated one. And that definition makes a lot of sense when you go back and you start looking at the seven different types of Pharisees. So if this is not something that you've looked at, it's information that you can take home, have, and possibly profit from. All right, we left off with Matthew chapter 23. Jeff was reading that for us. We want to go back and take a look at that as far as, and this drops us down to point number 29. So that other material, I put that on the sheet so you can have that if you want a full copy of the information. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 23 and do some reading. We'll start with Matthew 23, verse 13, and then also look at verses 15, 23 to 24, 28 to 31. And as Jeff reads this, we'll go ahead and stop at each of these places. Let's start, Jeff, if you will, you back in Matthew 23?
Yes.
All right, let's start with Matthew chapter 23 and look at verse 13. You know, that's a pretty stiff indictment against these people. Jesus says, first of all, when it comes to the kingdom of heaven, are you in or out? They're out. Well, that obviously would not be very, very good news if you're a Pharisee saying, here's the kingdom of heaven, this is something that you want, and you are not part of it. And then he also says what in that verse? There are the fellows who want to get in, and what do for them? You don't let them. By your teaching, by your influence, by your example, you keep others out. That's sort of a double indictment. You're not going there. You're not associated with the kingdom of heaven. And by your lives, you're also keeping other people out. When we think about judgment, God's judgment, when we've talked about this before, I know that not everybody may have the same assessment. But assuming that there are, for the sake of argument, assuming that there are degrees of punishment, the fellow who was not there, obviously, he's going to be punished, right? Not associated with the kingdom of heaven, accountable for your sins, you're not saved. If there are degrees of punishment, what do you think about the fellow who not only missed it, but he actively kept other people out of it as well? If there are degrees, then he should suffer more than the fellow who just missed it. So when Jesus gives this scathing condemnation in Matthew chapter 23, he really lays it on thick. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've said thus far, Stan?
Well, this might be backing up just a little bit. What qualified an individual to be a Pharisee? How did they get to be known as a Pharisee? Did they have a organization? Did they have somebody who said, okay, you're now smart enough to be a Pharisee, or you're rich enough to be one, or you're humble enough to be one? What qualified an individual to be a Pharisee?
Well, I don't know. There's probably some information out there, Stan, as far as the application process or the enrollment process. I don't know that I've ever seen that. It probably exists somewhere. My best answer for today would be over in Philippians chapter 3. Let's Let's start with about verse 2. He says, "Beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of the concision. For we are the circumcision who worship by the Spirit of God and glory in Christ Jesus and have no confidence in the flesh. Though I myself might have confidence even in the flesh. If any other man thinketh to have confidence in the flesh, I yet more. Circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law, a Pharisee, as touching zeal, persecuting the church, as touching the righteousness which is in the law, found blameless." Now that's sort of Paul's pedigree in brief. From that, I would conclude that you had to be very serious about the religion, and it would be just like someone today. This is what I'm inferring from that. That if you want to be a doctor, what's the process? You go to school, but you have some inclinations, perhaps. I mean, if you're a klutz and you want to be a brain surgeon, that's probably not going to work out too well. Yeah. Okay, or you want to be an auto mechanic and you're not mechanically inclined. That's probably not the direction that you want to go if you want to make any money or have repeat customers. So I would think, just like people today, if they want to be a preacher, for example, there needs to be, hopefully, some inclination towards that, maybe some skills, maybe some abilities, maybe the ability to put out material on a weekly basis and so forth. And that's kind of the sense that I get from Paul, that he was very interested in this line of work, so to speak, and he pursued that. He also had the background there for that as well. Now, to fill in some of the specific blanks as far as were they looking for more people from this tribe in contrast to that tribe, he studied under Gamaliel, which would also suggest to me that you would seek out a rabbi. And, you know, maybe the more prominent rabbi, just like today, when you think of attorneys, I clerk for a Supreme Court justice, or I went to this prestigious law school, those kinds of things. I don't know that you're going to find a lot of information that's going to suggest that the process was a lot different than any other line of work for Jews and just like you find today. So I might be able to dig up a little bit more information about that, but that would be my general answer.
Well, what prompted that question was you made the comment that Gamaliel seemed to be an individual that had his head screwed on straight. Well, then I started thinking, okay, so he was just a Jew. What qualified him to be a Pharisee? Just a curiosity question.
Yeah. Now, if you think about the Sadducees, they were more the political class, and they're, you know, what would qualify Chelsea Clinton to become president?
Last name, maybe.
Well, okay, I'm not throwing that out to be political, but I'm just saying there are some people who look at her and think, let's have her as the next president. All right, if you are of that persuasion, what qualifies her? I mean, she's still fairly young. The list of accomplishments, that's what people are looking at. They would say, and you think about the same thing when it comes to kings and queens. What would qualify you? Well, you're from the dynasty. You're from the family, so to speak. So some of that would be, you look at the high priest, for example, too. Caiaphas, Annas, the family connection there. So you sort of, born with the silver spoon in the mouth, and that may not be all you need, but oftentimes that's a big part of what you need. We've seen that with senators. We've seen that with congressmen as well. I'm thinking about, who's the one? Well, okay, that would be one, but there's another one. Is it New Jersey? He was the governor up there, and Christie. I think has a son who's a senator.
Christie?
No. Christie may be an appropriate example. The other guy. Well, there's a lot of other guys, so.
Whoever. Think of the Bush dynasty.
No, well, that would be another good example. But yes, again, you kind of see that there's a dynasty there. Well, that would be another one. That's still not the one that I had in mind. But you start going through the examples, and you can just have one right after the other. But I was thinking maybe Kasich.
Yes, might be him, but he's from Ohio.
No, it wouldn't be Kasich. Yeah. Who's the governor of, maybe, it wouldn't be New Jersey's Christie. Yeah, I can picture the guy, just can't call the name. But anyway, all right, let's head back to the sheet unless somebody else has something. Okay, let's go back to Matthew chapter 23. Jeff, that's where we left off with you, and look at verse 15.
Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you compass sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, you make him twofold more than the child of hell than yourselves.
Okay, now Stan, this may also factor into your question a little bit. You're making proselytes. So there was that process there that they used to train people. And I think you have to look at that in terms of like Gamaliel. They would have a rabbi that they would follow around for a few years before they would get their own following, and then they would be considered a rabbi, so to speak. But think about the evangelistic zeal of these fellows. Do you think they really went all around the world to convert somebody? All right, that would be a big part of it. But still, you didn't answer my question. Do you think they went all around the world to convert somebody?
No,
they're not coming over to North America to try to convert people.
They could raise Abraham, you know, they were Abraham's children.
Yes. But what's he mean when he says, ye compass, land and sea?
You make every effort.
Yes, that's a metonymy. You're saying this and you don't literally mean that, but you're going all out to find people. Again, some would come to them. You would think if a person was inclined, maybe such as Paul, that he would have sought out the very best one. And so, you know, it's like school sometimes. You see the same thing. If you are a good athlete, do the schools send scouts?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you know, they're going to scout out high schools and so forth. They're always looking for the best people. The military does that as well. But it can work the other way, doesn't it? You as the star athlete, you're interested in this school or that school, so you're going to contact them and say, look, I play, you know, football. And so it can sort of be a mutual checking out. You have them coming this way, and the student is also making contact as well. So it's an old, old process. All right, Jeff, 23 and 24, same chapter, if you would.
Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat, and swallow again.
Ouch. Can you imagine if you were a Pharisee? You'd given your life to religion. This is who you are as far as your identity. And Jesus comes along and says, you are a guide. Oh, praise God. Yes, we are. But then Jesus says, you're what kind of guide? You're a blind guide. Owie. I bet that hurt. And then he says some other things. You strain out what?
You strain.
Had a gnat.
Had a gnat and swallowed a camel.
Yeah. I think once they thought about that for a minute, they realized that probably was not a compliment.
Basically, he was saying they're phony.
Yes, you're paying attention to the little stuff, and you forget the big stuff. Can people in life do that today?
Oh, yes.
So focused on the little stuff, the minute stuff of life, and they neglect the big things. Where does that happen?
Well, even in your families, you're so busy making a living, you forget to have a life. And it seems like the gnats are more persistent and get your attention and are more demanding than the big things like paying attention to your kids. They just kind of are there.
Sure.
Easy to overlook.
Yeah. Anybody ever seen somebody clock in? And I mean, they are always on time. They don't clock in a minute late. Now, they don't do very much when they get there. But, I mean, if you want somebody to clock in on time, they are there. They never miss. I mean, if it's 7 o'clock as far as when the time clock goes off, always click.
Go straight to the
and they're not going to leave a minute early. So when you look at the time card, I mean, it's always right. But in that same shop, you've got somebody who may come in a couple minutes late. But you know, the way that they work, they give 110%. Which guy you want working for you?
One that gives.
The one that's a couple minutes late. Now, ideally, he'd be there at 7 and clock out at 5 or whatever the checkout time is. But, you know, really, if you are the employer in that business, you really don't care that Joe comes in a couple minutes late. But you do care that Sally is there on time and she doesn't give you a full 8 or 10 hours work. And that's what these people were doing. Now, not in the sense of the time clock, but they were paying attention to the smallest stuff and the biggest stuff. It was being overlooked. And Jesus says this is a problem. And we still understand that today. All right, verses 28 to 31. Jeff?
Even so, you also outwardly appear as righteous unto men, but within ye are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we have not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye be witnesses unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets.
Okay, these guys could talk a good game. You talk to them and they would have seemed like the most religious, the most righteous people you would have ever met. But Jesus says, what's true on the inside? You are a scummy, vile, evil hypocrite. You're a liar. You're a snake. And we talked about that, remember, last week? Vipers? John the Baptist referred to them as a brood of vipers. And Jesus comes along at a later time in his life, and for the most part, that was true of the Pharisees. So he really comes down on them very, very hard in Matthew chapter 23. All right, before we start running the rest of the references, any hands? Let's get some helpers lined up. Luke chapter 11, verse 43. We'll also ask you to read Luke 11, 53. Luke 11, all right, that'll be Terry. Then let's take a look at Luke 16, verse 14. Who's going to take that one? All right, that's going to be Gary. Luke 16, 14. And then Luke chapter 18, 11, and 12. Who wants it? Luke 18, 11, and 12. That'll be Steve Saylor. Let's go back to Luke 11. We start with Luke 11, verse 43. What did the Pharisees want?
Well, they wanted to be seen. They wanted the best seats.
Let's read it.
Okay, here you go.
11, 43.
Woe to you Pharisees, for you love the best seats in the synagogue and greets in the marketplaces.
Okay, this goes back a little bit to what Stan was talking about, not Pharisees and James, but as far as seating. They wanted what kind of seat?
The best.
Best. Now, you have a humble person comes in, maybe a few minutes late for services. Where's he probably going to sit?
In the back.
In the back. Maybe even stand. Yeah. But you got the old Pharisee comes in a little late. What's he going to do?
Walk up front.
Yeah. And probably going to be humble about it?
No, he won't sit.
Everybody's going to see. Cough a little bit. Jingle his money, you know. Put on the good show so everybody knows that Mr. Hypocrite has come to services. That stuff is not new. It's been going on for a long time. All right, Terry, let's take a look at that same chapter. And look at verse 53.
53. All right.
Luke 11,
verse 53. Okay. And as he said these things to them, the scribes and the Pharisees began to assail him vehemently and to cross-examine him about many things. And I'll go on to 54 if you want me to.
That's okay. Let's stop right there for now.
Okay.
They hear Jesus, and what do? Happy or not?
No, they're not happy.
Very unhappy. So they begin to cross-examine the Lord concerning how many items? Many things. So Jesus really puts them on the spot, and they respond, but there's really not much that they can say as far as a successful answer. Luke 16, verse 14. That's next. You know, that's an interesting verse because it gives us a little different dimension that we've looked at thus far as the Pharisees. Jesus said they were covetous. You would hope if somebody is really religious when it comes to money and possessions, what's their attitude? All right, well, that wasn't what I was thinking of, but that's exactly right. They're going to be generous. They're not going to be clinging on to what they have. They're going to be willing to share money, wealth, possessions. That's not going to be what they're focused on. But that was not true for these guys. All right, Luke chapter 18, verses 11 and 12.
The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men.
Okay, can they? Okay. I'm sorry, I did cut you off a little earlier, Steve. 11 and 12.
Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector, I fast twice a week, I give tithes to all that I possess.
Imagine, if you will, a Sunday morning. It's time to pray. The person who gets up and prays, God, I thank you that I'm not like the rest of these worshipers. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers. And you're listening to that public prayer. You think the elders are going to hear a little something when worshipers leave? You think some people are going to be upset? I think you're going to have a lot of people upset. God, I thank you that I am not like the rest of men. I'm a Pharisee. I'm a bleeding Pharisee. I'm a humpback Pharisee. I'm one of the other four kinds, as far as the bad kinds. Carol?
Well, I bet today when this Pharisee would pray publicly, he wouldn't be so blunt. He would go about it a different way so that we might not pick it up right away.
It could be. And if he did that, that also might tie into the idea of haughtiness, pride. I'll just fool these people. And my super spirituality, I'll just cloak that a little bit. Whichever way they went, it would definitely be bad. But if you had somebody that was this open with it, so blunt with it, people would really be offended. But people were used to this stuff.
Yes.
So when Jesus comes along, you can imagine the average Jew was probably just itching to go after these guys, but nobody was willing to touch that. And we spoke about that a little last week because these fellows sort of had it locked up. I mean, you've got about 6,000 Pharisees, remember? That's a lot of people. That's a big group to oppose. So if you're the Jew who is sitting there in the pew and you're hearing this stuff, it's kind of like, I don't like it. But, you know, when I'm there in the temple, when I'm there in the synagogue, when I'm there in the marketplace and these guys show up, this is just the way life is. And things are as they are, so I'm going to have to take it.
Are they still around today, Pharisees?
I believe, Bonnie, that after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, that pretty well put the end to these guys. So in spirit, they obviously are, but as far as name and sect of the Jews, I'm not aware of it in any sense. Anybody else?
Brand,
Terry?
You can almost picture them like having their own entourage and
sure.
their own cheering section, basically.
Yeah.
And they would probably go before them. And you know, you can see it today in some people with their body language.
Yeah, and it had to make the Jews who were really trying to do what was right sick.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Building on that, let's take a look at Matthew 5, verse 20. Let's go to helper lined up there. Who was going to take care of it? Matthew 5, verse 20. All right, Betty? And then Matthew 16, 12, we'll take that one. Matthew 16, verse 12, Lois. Then we'll take a look at Luke 7, verse 30. Luke 7, 30. All right, Kitty. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, and thinking about this in light of the comments that Terry just made.
For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of heaven.
Okay, now you've probably read that many times. But think about it in terms of today's class as well as last week's material. Jesus said, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, what's true? You're not going to make it. Where? Heaven. Doesn't that make sense? We've looked at all the bad things about these guys, and Jesus says, if you're living in this way, hell is going to be the right place for you. That makes perfect sense. Let's take a look at Matthew 16, verse 12. I need to back up a little bit. In that same chapter, let's also look at verse 6. I missed that passage on the outline. Matthew 16, 6, and then we'll look at Matthew 16, 12.
And Jesus said to them, watch out and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees.
Okay, so they're a little confused about that. What's the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Verse 12 explains.
Then they understood that he did not say to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees.
Okay, so these guys are covetous, they're putting on a show, they also had faulty teaching, and Jesus says, beware of that, it's like leaven. It's going to infect you in a bad way if you partake of it. Luke 7, verse 30.
Pharisees and lawyers rejected the counsel of God against themselves, being not baptized.
Okay, two quick points there. They rejected the baptism of John the Baptist, and Luke 7:30, in the first part says they rejected for themselves the what of God? The counsel of God. Think about that. Here is God's counsel. The people reject it. Can you imagine being so arrogant that you reject the counsel of God on any point? That's what these guys are willing to do. And Jesus faults them for it. All right, let's pick up three more passages. Well, let's just get all five ready and then we'll finish it up. John 7, 47 and 48. Gary. And then let's take a look at John 8. 3-5, Gary, we'll ask you to also flip over there. I'll give you that reference again. So John 7, 47 and 48, and then I'll give you John 8, 3-5. John 12, 19. Steve, and then we'll take a look at Steve Saylor, and then we'll look at John 12, 42. Steve, we'll also ask you to get that one. I'll give you that again. But John 12, 19 is where you start. And then John 18, 3, Carol, and then let's take a look at Matthew 27, 62. Matthew 27, verse 62. Betty. Let's go back to John 7, 47 and 48. Gary?
Then answered them the Pharisees, are ye also deceived? Have any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed on him?
Isn't that arrogant? Concerning Jesus. Have any of the who? Pharisees believed on who?
Jesus.
Well, the implication is no or very few. So if we haven't believed on him, then what? He's not worth it. Everybody should reject him. How arrogant. All right, Gary, let's move to that next chapter, John chapter 8, 3-5.
And the scribes and the Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what sayest thou?
Now, isn't that convenient? These guys want to entrap Jesus. The perfect trap is adultery. Jesus happens to be in their area. And who do they just quote-unquote find? There's this woman, and there's not a report about her being adulterous. There's the statement what? She was
caught
in the very act.
All by herself.
Yeah, all by herself. The man is not brought. How likely do you think all of those points are to just magically line up like that? Not too likely. So likely they set her up. And then they know Jesus is in the area, and then they bring her without the man. So again, you can imagine that they were using this woman, and not to say that she was innocent by any means, but they were using this woman, and they were supposed to be so religious, and that gives you some idea how just unseemly they were. John 12, verse 19, and then we'll take a look at John 12, 42. World's gone after him instead of who?
Them.
Us. And we're going to lose our position, our place, our power, so we better get rid of this Jesus character. And again, you see an attempt to do that back in John chapter 8. Steve, same chapter, if you will, verse 42.
Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue.
Isn't that rich? The Pharisees had enough control where if people confessed Christ, what were they going to do? We're going to kick you out of the synagogue. They weren't interested in truth. They weren't interested in righteousness. Quickly, John chapter 18, verse 3.
Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came with lanterns and torches.
All right, isn't that interesting? When you think about the group that came to arrest Jesus, who was part of the delegation?
The Pharisees
were part of that group. And then Matthew 27, verse 62. Okay. When it's time to go and inquire about Jesus' body to make sure that they can deny the resurrection, hopefully, or any claim about it, the Pharisees show up for that as well. So very, very interesting. They are, throughout the life of Jesus, they also are involved with the apostles, and a very interesting force to study when we look at the life of Christ.